That's how it is, though. That's how it is, though. We'll never be just fine. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though. We'll never be just fine. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though. And you're always on my mind. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though. We're running out of time. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though. And you're always on my mind.
Sunshine every day to delay the month of May. Get closer to the sun, cause winter time has just begun.
I can't believe this shit again. It's getting worse again. This time it's in Ferguson. The revolution televised and tweeted. Okay. Broadcasting internationally. Okay. Ain't no way you can't see it.
No.
Huey Newton, he knew what we'd be doing in the future.
Yes,
America
sir.
Never healed. It's tested over the suit. Infected over the views of oppressors holding on to. Lessons learned through the youth and make less of those who run through. Shit, they never will. This motherfucking bias make a nigga wanna rise. Frustration becoming violence. How this aggression feels. Same way how this depression feels. I can't realize which weapon's real. I got my hands up, cause I can die. They said it wasn't about color, but that's a damn lie.
That's how it is, though. We'll never be just fine. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though. We'll never be just fine. That's how it is, though. That's what it is, though.
Welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack. We are a weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create a lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. I'm joined, as I always am, by my awesome co-host, Ricky L. Hines II. What's going on, Ricky?
Nothing much. Just making this tea.
Making that tea happen.
It's going to be a good one. It's probably going to be a long one, but this is going to be a good one.
I'm excited about it. If you don't know Ricky, he's a Los Angeles native, U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger. He's also founder of the Americans United Again movement. He hosts two other podcasts, the Americans United Again podcast. A new episode just came out this week. You guys should definitely check it out. And also co-hosts with the lovely Sherelle, the AUA Hope podcast as well. And if you have not heard of us before, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network or go to our website, FergusonResponse.org. And we are lucky enough to have a guest today. We have Aaliyah Brown. How are you doing from the frozen tundra that is Michigan?
Yes, I'm great. I'm cold, but great.
Awesome. Aaliyah is a doctoral candidate and visiting scholar at the Michigan State University Museum. And prior to starting her PhD, she was the curator at the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. And she's interested in using museums as public forums. And we welcome her to the show. And Aaliyah, tell everyone where they can find you on Twitter and out in the internets.
Sure, you can find me on Twitter, and my handle is at Aaliyah Brown, that's A-L-E-I-A-B-R-O-W-N, and I also have a website, aaliyahbrown.org.
Awesome, great, and we'll make sure to have all of those contact links in the show notes. So today's podcast, we're going to be talking about white supremacy. I would be remiss not to just talk a little bit about the Department of Justice report that came out regarding both Darren Wilson and the Ferguson Police Department. So I'll just leave that out there. Ricky, really quick, your thoughts on the report and kind of the aftermath of it and what you think will happen from here.
I think it just sends it the same message that we've had from the beginning, and that's that really for these individuals, unless it's in a civil case, there's not going to be much justice for them. Mm-hmm. The system isn't set up to allow justice for them.
Right.
However, in the course of these investigations, we at least find out just how these types of things happen. And more often than not, it's a deeply racist police department who feel with some sort of superiority complex, not just from the standpoint of being white, but from the standpoint of being officers. They feel like they can do and treat people however the hell they want.
Right.
So you know, when you allow for those two things, racist people who feel like they can treat people however the hell they want, kids die.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, not to say that it's better or worse, but I think that the thing that it drove home for me was, you know, this, we always talk on this show a lot about the financial gain that the country is set up to use on the backs of Black people from the time of slavery through now. And so this was a really clear illustration of the modern equivalency of that and how we are set up to be a business for municipalities, and that they are gloating and rewarding themselves, patting themselves on the back for taking advantage of those who need the most help and can afford the least to be taken advantage of. So
I mean, we're essentially funding our own incarceration.
Exactly. And,
I mean, the residents of Ferguson are funding their own incarceration because they're disproportionately stopped for traffic fines, for things like that, and then these things get lumped onto them to a point where they're out thousands of dollars or $1,500 even for a simple ticket just because they couldn't afford to pay it.
Correct.
And so they're funding, and that's what the city's using for most of its revenue. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
Yep.
It's making its money off of taxing Black people through law enforcement.
And then training officers to see that as their function.
Yeah.
Which is really what the report was focused on. And then also the second piece, which is what you said, was this idea of disrespecting them being cause enough for interaction, and just a consistent approach to Black citizens of escalation versus de-escalation. So that part was very driven home as well. Aaliyah, what were your, I don't know if you've gotten to see too much of the coverage. I know it's been like think piece and analysis after, and every time I go online, I've seen another one that I've been like, oh yeah, this one's really good. But have you seen anything out there that's really stuck out to you?
Yeah, well, I'll first just talk about my gut reaction. First of all, it took me 2 days to actually read through the entire report because I was just, I don't know, it was traumatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though I study history and I'm very familiar with the long history of racialized violence against Black people, the long history of state police being against Black people, each time I read about the racist incidents of police committing crimes against Black people, the Black citizens of Ferguson, it was still very heart-wrenching, even though, you know, I already came into it kind of knowing that that was the case. So, it's incredibly sad, but it also made me think about how people consistently, especially in this country, deny that racism exists. Mm. And that report, especially the second part of it, gave us so much evidence that not just regular citizens are subscribing to racism, but people who are supposed to be in law enforcement and protection are seriously subscribing to racism. So it was just heart-wrenching for me. And it's always like having me constantly think about solutions and what needs to happen from here.
Absolutely. And you're right. It was really heart-wrenching to read. It was a long read. I was looking at Wes Lowry from the Washington Post tweets. He tweeted as he was reading the report, and so I could see him getting like more and more agitated in his tweets, where he was like, I can't believe, you know, this is just crazy, you know. And two things that struck out to me. One was, Ricky mentioned the statistic about, you know, the number of times that Black motorists were pulled over and all those things. When you think about the population of African Americans in Ferguson, not all of them have cars. I think they have between 10 and 13% of the citizens of Black citizens don't even own a vehicle. So the numbers, when you really look at them and you dig a little bit deeper, it gets even worse than what they even look like now, because they're just taking face value that every one of those Black citizens could have been in a car. And in reality, that's not even the case either.
Exactly. And, you know, that also reminds me of the section that I read about where, one ones who were trying to check on a significant other who may have been in a car crash or something, those people were also arrested or detained. And that seemed absolutely absurd. I'm not sure if you you remember what I'm referencing
yeah,
to, but essentially, like, say, I think it was a boyfriend got in a car accident, mm-hmm. and the girlfriend went over to try to console him and see if he was okay, and the police detained her.
Mm-hmm. And I think
and
so. Yep.
That's just absolutely ridiculous to think about, you know, that no one, there was no medical help for him or anything because they were so busy trying to detain her. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really crazy. And then the other thing that I noted was they made specific note of, on the one hand, the officials and police officers gave the impression that lack of personal responsibility among African-American members of the Ferguson community was what caused African-Americans to experience disproportionate harm under Ferguson's approach to law. And then the investigation showed that over and over and over again, these same officials would get tickets and municipal fines erased from their friends and family. They'd write emails. Ferguson's mayor emailed the prosecuting attorney in August of 2013 about a parking ticket received by an employee of a nonprofit day camp for which the mayor sometimes volunteers. The mayor wrote that the person, quote, shouldn't have left his car unattended there, but it was an honest mistake. I would hate for him to have to pay for this. Can you help? And then they deleted it, the ticket. In March 2014, a friend of the court clerk's relative emailed the court clerk with a scanned copy of a ticket, asking if there was anything she could do to help. She responded, "Your ticket of $200 has magically disappeared." Later, in June of 2014, the same person emailed the court clerk regarding two tickets and asked, "Can you work your magic again? It would be deeply appreciated." The clerk later informed him one ticket had been dismissed and she was waiting to hear back about the second one. So you have a situation where these people are saying, oh yeah, these black people, they don't take responsibility for themselves. And then they're completely not holding themselves accountable for the same infractions that they're disproportionately accusing black people of. It's like, it's so egregious.
Yeah, and to be honest, this, like, the entire report basically goes back to confirming common sense that based on the other data that we've already had. Think about it. Before this report came out, we knew that there were an average of, what is it, three summonses per household?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
When crime was down.
Down.
That sounds, regardless of how you slice that up, especially when you consider the fact that roughly 80% of the stops were of African Americans, It's no secret. This is, I know that we're getting into the details now, but there's no way that you could have not known this.
None
just
at
looking
all.
At the data.
None at all.
Just looking at, it's just math.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
It is really just math. The other article that I noted last week that came out was the building of the first slavery museum in America. This is opening in Louisiana on the Whitney Plantation in the town of Wallace, 35 miles west of New Orleans. It has been funded by John Cummings, who is a trial lawyer from the New Orleans area, and he bought what used to be the largest slave-holding plantation in the state to turn it into a not an art gallery or a plantation tour. It actually is a true representation of the life of a slave on the plantation from cradle to grave, and also a huge reverence to the people that gave their lives on the plantation and lived there in servitude. I mention it only because there are so many plantations in Louisiana. Drew and I used to live in New Orleans, so we're unfortunately well-versed in the fact that lots of them are set up as tourist spots. Mm-hmm. And it's a really disturbing, people get married at them, and it's a very strange kind of thing where you see, you can see a slave marriage reenactment. And it's like treated like, like a colonial, town experience versus the historic and barbaric practice that slavery was in reality. So I'm happy to see that one of these plantations has been put forth to actually tell the truth of the experiences and the things that happened there. And I know it took a lot of time and millions of dollars to do it, but interested to see what moves forward from there. What were your thoughts? I don't know if you've heard about this, Aaliyah, prior to this, you know, you being the museum expert on the line here.
Yeah, I was thoroughly excited about this museum, and mainly because I did go to grad school in the South, and it seems like there is a slave plantation anywhere you could throw a rock. But all of those plantations or museums, historic sites, however they were set up, there are very few of them that even acknowledge enslaved people, which is a critical problem because there again we're getting back to people kind of ignoring or willfully ignoring the fact that America has this disturbing racial past. Mm. So, it just amazed me how well we would avoid talking about enslavement. Like, they'd rather focus on the material culture, like the plates that a family used, rather than the actual stories of who was serving the family or who was building their buildings or who was being the blacksmith or who was nursing their children. So I'm very excited to see these stories come to light. And not, you know, like in a shallow way.
Right.
I know that there has been some attempts of interpreting enslaved people's lives, but it's been kind of to a point so that they don't offend their visitors. They don't want to make them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So they'll call them like servants or the servant had a good life, or, you know, instead of actually telling the truth about slavery and kind of digging into the horrors of what it meant to be an enslaved person in America.
Absolutely. And coming to terms with that, I think,
right.
That's going to be, obviously, whenever you talk about white supremacy, that theme is going to reoccur because, to me, it's a reckoning that is really the only way for us to move forward and try to move forward in this country is to have that moment of clarity and to, shake off this notion that the ideals of this country are equal to its history. It just isn't the truth. And the sooner we all come to terms with that, the better off everyone will be. And we talk about it a lot on this show. So I'm excited to talk about the specifics. We talked, Ricky did two episodes ago about the sociology of white supremacy, but we are going to be talking about the history and origins of it in this country. And then some of the somewhat hidden or not so much thought of effects of it in the lives of African Americans today. So to open that, I actually want to play a really quick clip from a talk that Ta-Nehisi Coates gave, actually was in the audience for this particular lecture. It was here in Pennsylvania at the University of Pennsylvania. So I'll just let him talk for just 1 second. I think it's like a minute clip.
And I think people really, really need to be clear. Now, it may, you know, show up. He declares himself. I'm only taking him at his name. As president of the United States. As president of America, not just black America. As president of America, I think that demands a certain pose in terms of how you address African Americans.
So I want to turn back. We'll come back to President Obama again, I think. But I want to turn back to the big picture history that you're offering in your article about reparations. And really, the way that government, as you describe in the article, is fundamentally intertwined with the process of racial inequality, of perpetuating racial injustice in the United States. And again, not just coming from the right, but coming from the Democratic Party, from the New Deal, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So could you talk a little bit about that line of the argument? Because in some ways, the heart of your article on reparations is not where most people focus on, which is the institution of slavery, and that 250 years, but really the period from the 1930s on forward. And so I want to hear a little bit more about your analysis of that.
Well, listen, white supremacy is a force that lives at the root of America. It does not live at the root of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And I think people really, really need to be clear. Now, it may, you know, show up in different parties at different points in history, but it lives at the heart of this country. Understand that it becomes, you know, it doesn't become very surprising. At certain points in this history, in our history, you had a Democratic Party that, you know, was enacting policies which are widely considered populist, which a lot of progressives celebrate, that excluded African Americans. In 1938, how else would those policies have gotten passed? If you understand the country as it was in 1938, 1939, 1940, not just thought experimenting it out, you know, but understanding the country that you actually would have been, how else would those policies have been passed? African Americans were effectively a peon class at that point. And, you know, to some extent today, you know, living under terrorism, living under lynching, you know, and I'm just going to salute Tom here.
Okay. So we'll stop there. I just wanted to have Ta-Nehisi give us a quick overview, which is that, yes, white supremacy is at the root of our country, and we are tasked today with talking a little bit about those roots and what that would mean. I also just quote him very quickly. He was asked why he wrote the case for reparations, and he said that he's always said that, to be perfectly blunt, there's nothing wrong with black people that the complete and total elimination of white supremacy would not fix. And that's what I believe. And I want black folk who read that piece to know you're okay, you know, that the conditions within the community are not okay, but as a human being, you are okay. So just really quick, just to kind of get your thoughts about that idea of white supremacy being at the root of the country and kind of what that means, and the fact that it's not something that certainly we're not taught it in schools, but also that it just isn't a part of our collective knowledge as a country, and the repercussions of that. Aaliyah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I'll go back to, you know, our brief discussion on the New Slavery Museum. That right there, telling the narrative how they're telling about the enslaved people, makes the visitors know that this country, looking at, you know, the microcosm of the largest sugar plantation in the Deep South, was built on black people's backs. Mm-hmm. The only reason why that plantation was so successful was because of white supremacy. And that's how the larger United States operated. So I think when we begin to actually dissect those narratives and look at why the United States is successful or not successful and see that white supremacy is at the root of it, then we begin to understand race relations and what we can do to fix it. I also believe in affirming narratives for black people. Mm-hmm. So I think that reading his piece on reparations, and especially that quote that you pulled, shows them that, you know, all of us, that we are good enough. We don't have to accept what this society has placed on us. We don't have to accept any of the negative stereotypes. We have to be confident within ourselves and know that we are good enough. So those are my initial thoughts.
Absolutely. Ricky, how about you?
Well, Professor Eddie Glau from he's the head of African American Studies at Princeton. He calls white supremacy a congenital disease. Mm. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, he's right. You think about just how important slavery was to the colonial South. Given the fact, and even them choosing to secede from Britain, like that was Britain's fault. To be quite honest, they weren't really all that ready to secede until until Britain sent over a representative just to kind of talk with them. He was brutal as fuck.
Right.
Like, they kind of changed their minds. And then at the time, the North had to figure out, if we profit off of slavery too, we don't want to fucking get rid of it. And this is the basis for their economy, so there's no way in hell they'll get rid of it. Yeah, it's kind of in direct conflict with our ideals and why we're even setting this country up, but fuck it, we'll, we'll let it ride for a little bit. Like when people say that this country has been built on the backs of slaves, it was maintained on the backs of slaves. Yep. It was held together on the backs of slaves. Yep. There's no getting around it. You can't hide from it. The reality is, every time that you go back and look at history, you see just how integral the system of slavery was to our country. Not just capitalism.
Yes.
Our country, our entire economy.
Absolutely. So I think for the first part here, we're going to talk about the history of white supremacy here in the United States and its origins. So I'll just read really quick. This is also from Ta-Nehisi. He says, the wretched treatment meted out to African Americans and the wretched treatment meted out to Native Americans in the minds of most white people is almost separate from the core idea of what America is. America is this place of democracy, freedom, all these other values, and these other things were sort of just mistakes that happened along the road, as opposed to thinking of those mistakes as things that actually made all those other good things possible. It's very hard for people to get their heads around that. I mean, how then do you think about your country? You know, if the founding fathers are not what you thought they were. So we'll start with the origins, and I wanted to start just really quickly to talk about Bacon's Rebellion of 1676, because it was a crucial turning point in terms of the building of white supremacy here in the quote-unquote New World. In Virginia, they had a record of about 10 different servant revolts that happened in the mid-1600s, culminating in Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. And Bacon's Rebellion represented a strange combination of popular resentment against the Virginia establishment and frontier hatred for Native people. Bacon, for his part, came from the ruling class and was mostly interested in securing his power and autonomy as a frontier leader who would raid and kill Indians at will. The rebellion, though, was much greater than Bacon himself. It was a large armed insurrection of African and British servants, free workers, and farmers. They burned Jamestown, the capital, to the ground and chased out the governor, demanding land and pay for their labor. Terrified their power was slipping, the British sent in the army to crush the rebellion, and they eventually did, hanging 23 of the rebel leaders in the process. Now, the rebellion itself is really important because it represented a growing class consciousness among African and English servants and a willingness for response on a military side. So this threatened the colony. The establishment was like, yeah, this can't happen. And so they introduced the first piece of law that legislated black and white in America. This is really fundamental because it drew a color line into the law, as well as into the American psyche, and it set a precedent for the tactic of divide and conquer that has been employed ever since to make sure that the power continued to reside in the hands of few at the expense of the many. So right in that moment, we see that poor whites and enslaved Africans are joining together because they're both getting screwed by the establishment. And what does the establishment do? They say, you are just a little bit better than them. And right there, we have the seed planted of white supremacy here on the fertile lands of what will become the United States shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. Have you done much study in this area of American history, Ali? I don't know if that's something that has gone into.
No, this is actually way before my time period. So I focus on 20th century African-American history, but I do see Bacon's Rebellion as an important thing to mention as a precursor to any study that you do in the 20th century. But I like talking about Bacon's Rebellion because, you know, oftentimes when we bring up the inequities or racial disparities, people's counter argument is that poor people are suffering too. Mm. And that's very true. But, still at the root of it, I think this country, race inequities outweigh class inequities. And I'm sure some people will disagree with me, but I think Bacon's Rebellion and the legislations and attitudes that came out of that showed that regardless, they didn't want class cohesion, that they had to break it up by race. So I still think that black people suffer the most out of all people in this country.
Absolutely. And you're right. It leads directly to the slave codes of the 1980s. I'm sorry, 1680s, which legitimized chattel slavery as an institution. And the specific designation was that a child born to a black slave is automatically a slave, which would not be the case for a white person that was indentured servitude.
Right, like a white indentured servant.
Correct. So it made this distinction that you can arise above your current class as a white person, but as a black person, you and your progeny never will.
Right. And I think that's why that counter argument falls flat with me, that, you know, people often always say, well, poor people are suffering too, or they're just as disadvantaged, and I don't think that's true.
Right. And I think they fail to see that you can say that certain poor people may be more disadvantaged than specific black people. But if we're talking about systemic things, you don't have the argument to make at all, which I know, Ricky, you talk about that all the time. You know, just that false.
Yeah, I call it like, and for anyone who doesn't know, like I'm guest hosting John and Molly's The Penniman Doctrine while Molly's out. And we were talking about the Negro multiplier, as I call it, because whatever you like, whatever the problem is, poor, LGBTQ, blind, deaf, dumb, it doesn't matter. Whatever that issue is, multiply by 2.3 and you have the black equivalent.
Absolutely.
And it's the same thing with poverty. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with just even the slave codes.
Absolutely. And from here, we have language that comes directly out of these first laws that are enacted, where slave is equated with black or Negro and servant is equated with white. So right before any shots are fired or any idea of a declaration of anything occurs on this land that we call our country now, we have already started to see that white supremacy is taking hold. And I say all the time that I'm not surprised that we are dealing with the issues we are now, because we had poor seeds planted. And this is the rotten fruit that we are being born now that we have to kind of deal with and decide what we're going to do as a nation. So as I mentioned earlier, we will move on to our founding fathers, who I have lots of thoughts on. I rail about this concept all the time of how great they are, especially all of the Tea Partiers out there who love to talk about the wondrous, wonderful people that are our founding fathers.
Who would hate them, by the way. Who would absolutely despise them, with the exception of their racism.
It's the God's honest truth. It's crazy. Which was interesting, because I think a couple of weeks ago they had an article in, I think it was the New York Times, called George Washington Slave Catcher, which everybody, I was seeing it all over the place. People were sharing it all over, just kind of going through. You know, he's the father of our country, as he's referred to quite often. And I think people often, it's one of the most quote-unquote whitewashed portions of our history, is this notion of so many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence not just owning slaves, but actively owning slaves, continuing to purchase slaves, and furthering slavery, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. George Washington signed the first Slavery Fugitive Act, first of all, and himself utilized that act to actively seek slaves that have run away from his plantation or his purview. So I find it interesting, and I don't know what it is. Actually, I haven't brought this up to a white person to see what their thoughts are on it, or if they're surprised by it. What do you guys think? Do you think people are shocked when they hear this?
No. I mean, it's good for the... In all honesty, it was good... George Washington did what was good for the country. If it had to fuck over a few black people, some slaves who didn't matter to him anyway, he was going to do it. I mean... It's fucked up as it is. We have to begin to admit that people are human beings. They're not to be made legends out of. George Washington was not a legend. Benjamin Franklin was not a legend. No one from that colonial time was a legend, and any more than our current leaders are.
Right.
They had a really good idea, and they were actually fucking civil enough to get along, unlike now. But they had a really good set of ideals that they couldn't quite work out because, slavery's how this fucking economy functions. I'd be stupid to dismantle it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if I felt that this was morally wrong at any point in my life, if I come to that realization, I'd tear the country down in doing this. Probably not the best idea.
Right.
And it doesn't make it right.
No.
Because yes, you've done that. Now you've go back and fix what you've had to fix or fix what you fucked up along the way. Like I don't think any Black American as long as they felt that the things that have been done to their ancestors benefited them in the long run, to where it was like, you know what, this was wrong, but at least they've made up for it. It would go so much, it would do so much for the Black community, because you can't continue to just get beat like this and be okay with it.
And beyond that, not have it acknowledged, because I feel like that's part of the real piece, the psychological piece of the puzzle, is that with no actual acknowledgement that this is our history, that this is what happened, that these founding fathers that you expect us as Black people to worship and celebrate and be okay with their actions were in fact the architects of the structure of oppression that we have lived under for 400 years. So it goes beyond just the tactical part of it. To me, it goes so much to a psychological piece, where if you understood this history and you see exactly what's going on and what has happened and how we got to where we are, you would never open your mouth and say stuff like, well, Black people need to be more accountable. Accountable?
Exactly, Leslie. That's why you'd never go that far.
You wouldn't.
That's why you don't think that far. Because if you acknowledge that everything that happened was fucked up, then you'd have to acknowledge that it needs to be made up for.
Mm. Yeah, this is true.
That's why, like, honestly, that's why I have to toe a line between trying to lead white people along slowly and not being nice about it.
Right.
Like, not really, you know, just punching them in the face a little bit at a time. Like, hey, look, this is what happened. Oh, you're mad that I punched you in the face? Really? You shot my ancestors. You cut their feet off. You dismembered them. You're mad because I punched you in the face, metaphorically.
But I think also there's this notion that slavery just happened. It just
occurred. Yeah.
You know, even you saying that, you know, that it was just something, you know, he just did what was right for the country. It's like, yes, but then when you see that a place like George Washington, when they moved the capital here to Philadelphia passed the law. They passed a kind of anti-slavery law. They were basically gradually getting rid of slavery. It was the Abolition Act of 1780. And so after their 28th birthday, a slave was automatically freed. And if they stayed in the boundaries of Philadelphia, actually Pennsylvania, not just Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, for six months, they were automatically also set free. So our first president, seeing this, couldn't have his slaves being set free.
He'd cycle them around.
So he would cycle them. So this is not just passive activity. This is not just, well, I have a plantation and it needs to be kept and whatever. This is, I know that the law tells me I shouldn't be doing this anymore. And I, as the president of this nation, I'm going to secretly do all of these things. And I'm going to do what I want to. So this is where I feel like it's there's been this idea floated, like, oh, it's passivity and it just, slavery just happened to the country. It's like, no, it didn't just happen to anybody.
But I also like to add that we need to understand slavery and white supremacy as an intentional act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you were saying earlier, so often people see it as a mistake or something that went wrong. It absolutely went the way that they planned. Like, the language in the legislation back then marked Black people not as people. So, you know, they didn't count as people. Right. Even if you look at inventories of slave holdings, they didn't count them as people. So, we're starting from a point where the leaders at that time in the elite class at that time did not even see black people as human beings.
Nope.
And that further proves that this absolutely was not a mistake. It was an intentional system set up from the beginning.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it was one that evolved. I mean, to be quite honest, it started off as a system where, you know, you would just exclude, you would separate them just with language between, you know, slaves and servants. When you're talking about white and black, slaves, they're still fucking slaves.
Right.
But, you know, you go from that point to just liberating white people, poor white people, and making them a buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you still subject them to poverty, you just make them not as bad.
Not as bad.
Then you go from, and then you go from keeping black people in slavery against their will to just going and hunting them down, charging them for crimes, and then putting them back in jail, or putting them in jail as slaves.
Absolutely.
It's no secret that it's intentional because it keeps manifesting itself in so many ways.
Exactly.
Because the country has no, systems have no way of functioning without that piece being there. We have yet to address the fact of what will we do and how will this country truly function without preying upon black people. We have never confronted that fact because we've never admitted that that's what's going on. We've never said, hey, this is why we became a superpower. This is how we amassed all of the wealth that we were able to. This is what made us a leader during the Industrial Revolution. It was all upon that. And we continue today doing the same exact thing where companies are making money off of mass incarceration and keeping their costs and overhead low on the backs of black people. So and until we say, like, okay, this is how it's been engineered, what is the other way to do this? How are we going to function without taking advantage of people? That's never going to change. We touched a little bit on George Washington, but I want to also mention Thomas Jefferson. I put quotes around author of the Declaration of Independence because lots of other declarations were being written at the time that he wrote the original one. So there are lots of scholars who question that being attributed to him, but the only full length book he wrote was Notes on the State of Virginia. And in his book, I'll just run down a few things that eventual President Thomas Jefferson claims and purports to back his claims with scientific evidence that black people, upon liberation, would spark a race war, only ending with the annihilation of one side. They're uglier than white people. They cannot be understood or related to because their dark skin hides their emotions. Honest to goodness, I was going through this list in preparation for the show and it was like, oh my God. Each one of these points he points out, today we have study after study that says that black people's emotions are not read by white people. They think we don't hurt. Actually say that we do not feel pain. When I look at this list, okay, we desire white people more than other black people. We're comparable to apes. Black people smell bad. Black people are reckless and stupid to the point of not recognizing danger. Black people are more lustful than white people and do not understand real love. Do not feel grief for long because they lack the ability to reflect. They sleep when they're not working or fooling around because they also don't reflect. They're inferior in reasoning and imagination. They're incapable of understanding math, which is the most ridiculous crock of shit I've ever heard, considering Egyptians were doing math while Europeans were still in caves, but okay. Are intellectually inferior.
Or the math that it took to develop honestly, the different structures on your plantation.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Are intellectually inferior inherently, regardless of social context. They're musically inclined, but lack the ability to produce anything sophisticated. They might not even have written the few things credited to them. Listen to that one.
Can I point out something? To the extent that is true about any black person during that point in time was his doing.
Exactly. It's preposterous.
If that's true, it's probably because you fucking allowed for it.
Because
you did it on purpose. You forbid them from having any meaningful community or family relationships, in which a lot of those things even foster.
Yeah.
What did you expect? Right. You treated people like animals, and then in return, they began acting like animals.
That was one of the reasons why they were so afraid of black people learning how to read.
Yep, of course.
That was one of the critical tactics of keeping them in a state that was uninformed and, unsophisticated, as he attempted to say.
Yeah. The end of this list gets so bad, so I want to finish it real quick. They're smarter and more beautiful whenever they're mixed race. They didn't have it that bad, all things considered. They reproduce quickly because they lack restraint. If that's not a hearken call to the welfare queen, I don't know what is. They cannot blame slavery for their failings because some white slaves did awesome things, you guys. They are naturally deficient in intellect, but have plenty of emotion. Angry black woman or man are predisposed to being thieves because they don't get the concept of private property. They might just be a different species than white people. They shouldn't be emancipated because they're black and stupid. And finally, if liberated, they must be moved far away from white people in order to preserve white racial purity. Okay, so this is Thomas Jefferson, notes on the state of Virginia, and he lays out his hypothesis, his scientific evidence about black people. And for each one of these, I think we could draw a very direct line to things that are said about black people in this country to this day. And this from a man who raped one of his slaves to the point that they had an entire family separate from his own. It's kind of, these are the kinds of things that I just like shake my head to think of the importance of things like school boards and history books and how they're written and what is taught in our country. I don't think that anybody thinks about those things. And I think they keep black people struggling, so we don't even have the energy and bandwidth to worry about them.
I mean, they've driven many black people to apathy, just flat out. It didn't even take that much. That's all you have to do is drive people to where they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do whatever the hell you want to them.
Yep. Absolutely. Any final thoughts on the Founding Fathers before we move on to our next little bit of discussion?
You know what? It's kind of like a like admitting your grandfather's a rapist.
Mm.
And, you may love your grandfather. Your grandfather may be the best person in the fucking world to you. And he can also be a rapist.
Right.
As those two aren't mutually exclusive. And I don't think that, like, a lot of people see things in such binary manners that if they saw one, they wouldn't be able to see the other.
Mm.
And rather than see the bad, they'll just see the good. And you see that with a lot of people in general. They'll look at a person's good benefits or their positive qualities and completely ignore their negative ones. It's something about human nature. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but it's that ability to just completely devolve yourself of any real responsibility for living in reality.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
Well, it's easier. It's easier to accept that narrow narrative. You don't have to think about the negative side or the dark side of a person, and you can continue just to celebrate what you see as the positives. And I find even when I've presented these histories, whether they're through exhibits or educational tours, there's some people that just can't make that mental leap about our racist past and how it affects our present and future. They feel comfortable with just understanding kind of the narrow view of the founding fathers that you get in fourth and fifth grade United States history. So yes. I guess people feel comfortable with that, and it's easier. They don't have to do any type of mental or emotional internal work, because, you know, then you have to start questioning yourself about your own biases and how those stories have affected your outlook on life. You don't have to do all of that if you just accept kind of the narrative that's been peddled to us about the founding fathers.
Very true. Kind of not to say dumbing it down, but there is that level of it.
No, it's,
but I also think
it is.
It's
dumbing it down.
It is. It's dumbing it down, and it also, you know, I say this all the time. You talk to child educators, and there are complex things you have to convey to children all the time, whether it's death, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's loss, generally speaking, divorce. These are complex things that they have to suss out. And there's ways of talking about those complex things at every age that's appropriate to them. And this can be the same way. I'm not saying you come out and say, hey, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, did such and such.
A motherfucking racist.
Right.
It was right. Like, you can't just yell at it again.
That's not how you start the conversation, right. But you do start the conversation of making them seem like human beings that would make mistakes and that would do bad things, and that those bad things had consequences on people.
Exactly.
That's the conversation that needs to be had. And I think it's a much better approach to life, generally speaking, because it's the epitome of taking responsibility. It's the epitome of showing that there is responsibility to be taken. I this notion, and it's something that happens all the time with regard to Black people. It's always this, you know, that Malcolm X quote of, you know, if we're not careful, the media will have you believing that the oppressor is the victim and the victim is the oppressor. And this is the exact thing that goes on. You know, white people and the white media will say, you know, Black people aren't accountable for their actions. Like, you haven't been accountable for your actions ever.
Right.
What are you talking about? Listen to yourself. Yeah. You sound crazy right now. Accountability? Oh, okay. Let's talk about accountability if we're going to go that route, because it doesn't start with, I don't know, whatever you're trying to refer to, people on Medicaid. That's not where accountability starts, my friend. Yeah. Or not so friendly. So the second piece historically that I wanted to talk about was the role of white women during slavery and beyond as well. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk recently about white feminists and their relationship to women of color. And I know Ricky has heard me rail about this for the last week or so in various arenas. But I did want to just talk a little bit about this, because I think it's another very strong visual and narrative that we are fed with regard to the practice of slavery and where white women role fits into that. I think that we've been sold this, you know, white women were just going along with it, and they didn't really have anything to do with it, and they too were under the thumbs of the plantation owners, their husbands. And in reality, that really was not the norm. The norm was that the mistress of the house usually made most of the decisions with regard to the slaves. Decided who went where, decided who was paired, decided who was sold, and did not see the slaves that worked on the plantation as anything other than chattel, just like their husbands did. So I just wanted to touch on that a little bit, because I think it's a really big piece of the puzzle that consistently has portrayed white women as victim to great detriment through lynching through to today. We can go over and over the historical points at which white woman as victim has led to Black death, Black abuse, and to the detriment of Black people, generally speaking. And I find its roots here in this narrative, this notion of the, you know, put upon helpless Southern white woman who was on the plantation and just couldn't do anything else but go along with what was happening. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, I'd also like to add that in addition to white women taking a more active role in enslavement that is traditionally portrayed, they also had the hierarchy protecting them. So everything that white men did, especially in the South, was it essentially led back to protecting white women. You always see this language of protection and the fear of miscegenation and the fear of the black man rapist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they set up all of these things for white women to kind of float through society without ever really facing any problems. Even if you think about prisons and jails, for a long period of time, there weren't any of those institutions for white women.
No.
So they never really had to, like, pay for a crime. So, you know, in addition to them, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, that not only did they participate actively in these kind of racist and white supremacist things, but they were also very much protected throughout history.
Generally speaking, absolutely. That's a really great point. For sure. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, I think I don't remember when it was, but I do remember I was seeing a story about the first female prisoner. I think it was in either Missouri or Michigan, and it was very late in the 1800s. And they didn't even, she was in just a regular prison with the men. They didn't have, in the whole state, they did not have a women's prison. So, and she had, she'd killed her husband. That's why they had put her in there, and she ended up getting pardoned. So anyways, yeah. So that's a great point to make. For sure. So we're going to move on and talk about some of the hidden effects of white supremacy. I know Ricky wanted to play that piece about white supremacy playing out in American life. So let's take a listen to that.
Sorry. Right. So when we talk about white supremacy as a practice, what we're talking about is the very ways in which our social arrangements, right, orient us to one another in such a way that the basic claim that some people are lived out in our choices. Now that's kind of abstract, but let's kind of make it concrete. So there's a way in which most states fund schools, right, by local neighborhoods, right? I mean, we know how schools are funded, right, through property taxes. But we know that residential segregation, right, is thick, right, in the United States. And there was a deliberate effort to undermine efforts at coming out of the 1960s to really desegregate housing in the United States and neighborhoods. And so even though schools are funded by way of property taxes, and even though we know that residential segregation is rampant in the United States, we still are comfortable with making the choice that some people can go to bad schools and some people can't go to bad schools. Now some people can go to good schools. And that you don't have to be Bull Connor, right, to hold that view. You can just say, I want my kid to go to the best schools, right? And holding that view, you still perpetuate, right, the inequality that is rampant in the country. Now, at the same time that those choices are being made, right, I just want my kid to go to the best school, we need to live in a safe neighborhood, which means we leave these other people living in less than safe neighborhoods and going to bad schools, right, we can then say those people who attend those bad schools and those people who live in those bad neighborhoods live in those circumstances because of their behavior. It's not because of any choices that I'm making. I'm not deliberately racist, right? It's because their behavior is such that they don't exhibit, right, the wherewithal, the individual motivation to make themselves better. They just want government handouts. Their welfare bait, you know, welfare women and mothers, right? Their children are undisciplined, and Obama will say they're feeding them Popeyes for breakfast, with no mention of the fact that they're food deserts, right? Or they're not really performing in school with no real mention that there are 40 people in the classroom with an untrained teacher in front of them. So part of what we're saying is that when we think about white supremacy as a practice, we're not talking about people running around calling people the N-word or burning crosses. We're talking about the very way in which our society is organized, which reproduces benefits for particular people, right, and marginalizes others, right, because of just simply where they were born and the color of their skin. And then you have folks like me and folks like Obama, Brother Sam, who we can gain access to mainstream American life, right? And then we become the billboard for the inclusion, the inclusiveness of American life, when in fact we're as stratified and segregated as we've ever been.
Great. And that was
thoughts?
That was Professor Eddie Glau Jr., correct? I just want to make sure we're attributing to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that was a great overview, because we're going to talk a lot about quite a few of the things that Professor Glau touched on in that. And it's true. I think that there's this notion that white supremacy, much like white guilt is, much like white privilege, is something that black people mention to call white people bad people. And I think that a lot of the walls that get put up is because of that false narrative, that in discussing these things, we're making a personal judgment about individual white people. And the more we can kind of separate that fact, the better off we'll be in having these discussions, because that's not the case at all. Of course, there's nothing wrong with wanting your child to go to a good school. Okay. That's not what the conversation needs to be about. What the conversation is trying to be about is that, what does that desire mean to everybody else? And how do you allow that desire to play itself out in informing the rest of your thoughts about other people? And why do you allow that? That's what the conversation should be about. And I think it's a really important distinction to make, because we tend to try and put things in black and white when it's not that case. This supremacy is so ingrained in our society that we are unable at this point to tease out the variables of them any longer. I can't even think of the Negro multiplier. Yeah,
I told you. That's exactly what it is.
Yes. You can't untangle it anymore. And
it's like math.
Absolutely. Aaliyah, what were your thoughts just on that little piece that we listened to?
I like his definition of white supremacy, because I often think that when white people hear those words, fence automatically goes up. And it reminded me one time I was explaining to a colleague of mine how black people who protested in Selma, or just in Alabama in general, they often lost their jobs, their homes, and they didn't receive any type of government assistance if people found out they were protesting. And I use that as an example to show, like, the different obstacles that black people face. You know, they in this land of, like, democracy, they didn't even have the right to protest for their rights. And that is an effect of white supremacy. And so I told her to think about just the generational effects of, say, if your parent lost their job because they were protesting, what does that mean for you as their kid? That they aren't able to provide for you, that you potentially don't get to go to college. So I was showing her that because of white supremacy, it doesn't just affect one generation, it affects many generations, and it doesn't necessarily have to be something physically brutal. I think they always jump to, like, lynching or racialized violence, but it's also something that's economic and social status based here.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
It is. And it also gives a false narrative that, as, let's say, the economy gets better, when black people are not continuing to receive the same benefits from an economy getting better, or crime going down, or whatever the benefits that might be of advancements that we may achieve as a country, it allows the white populace to say that, well, it must be the black people's fault. I'm doing better. Why aren't they?
Yeah. When it comes economically, we're usually, it's usually at least twice as bad. Again, fuck the damn Negro multiplier. I swear. I think I'm about to, like, trademark that or something.
You might have to tease that one. Absolutely.
Because it's like it plays out in so many things, and you don't even think about it until it's like, oh wait, I just attributed a name to something that I think about all the time.
Absolutely.
When I was on the Onyx Truth Live, we had a discussion about police brutality. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time, not with Richard, with that fucking idiot. but it was a conservative guy. I'm presuming he was white. He pretty much, although he was the only one that didn't actually show his face during the video podcast. So he was talking about his friend getting out of the car to go check the headlight. I was like, oh, did he get shot? Is he alive? He's like, yeah. I was like, yeah, that doesn't always happen here. You see what I mean? And right. He's like, well, you know, the cop pulled the gun on him. Did he fire? No. Ah, see the difference? Even if, whether he hit him or not, being fired at is not something pretty. I've been shot at 3 times. It's not a fun thing to go through. It's just not.
Right. And it is a psychological barrier. My husband is white, and he had gone with my brother-in-law, who's black, to Sam's Club over like Thanksgiving or something. They went to get ice, and my husband had forgotten his Sam's Club card with me or something like that. So we had to go, you know, you go up, you give your ID, they give you like the temporary one or whatever. And he's like, I'm just getting ice. You know, can I just pay for it here? The woman's like, oh, yeah, sure. I'll just ring you up, whatever. Go grab the ice. So they go over to where the ice is, which is far from where he paid for it. And my husband grabs 2 bags of ice and just goes and takes off to walk out of the store. And my brother-in-law was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What are you doing? He's like, I'm going to the car. I paid for the ice. He's like, you can't just walk out. Where's your receipt? Like, my brother-in-law immediately was like, you can't just walk out of the store like that. They're going to think you're stealing it. And my husband was like, why would they think I was stealing it? I mean, in that moment, it was just a moment of these two men. They both have families. They both are great contributing members of our society. They own vehicles. They have homes. All of these things that are the same about them. But in that moment, it was very clear that they were coming from two completely different worlds in terms of what reality meant to each of them, strictly because of their skin color.
Yeah.
I don't think that white people quite grasp that aspect of it, that we, as black people in this country, are on a constant and vigilant watch to see what the impression of us is in that moment, because it can truly be life or death, or incarceration or not, or a fine or not, or humiliation or not. It can mean all of those things. It's definitely, you know, it's a long-term effect that this has. So one thing I wanted to touch on, which is obviously mass incarceration, which we don't even need to get into the facts behind that because they're very well meted out, not just in the Department of Justice report today, but in many books, including Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. But the industries that make money off of our mass incarceration, one being food supply companies. So supplying food for prisons can be extremely profitable. Aramark, which is based here in Philadelphia, brings millions of dollars of bringing food to around 600 prisons in North America. Mm-hmm. And their profits continue to roll even when the company does a terrible job. They received fines in 2014 of $98,000 and $200,000 from the state of Michigan for a long list of infractions, including meal shortages and unsanitary conditions. And their employees smuggling contraband into the prisons. But they've paid a small fine, and they still were able to sign a 3-year, $145 million contract with the state of Michigan after those infractions were paid off.
Wow.
That's just one option. Telecommunications, which is one of the biggest blights on keeping prisoners separated from their families in a real, real way in terms of their incarceration, which is one of two indicators for recidivism, which is the other being education while being incarcerated. Globaltel Link, GTL, they have been making $500 million annually in profits thanks to its exclusive profits with a long list of prisons. And when prisoners make a collect call via GTL, the person pays an inflated rate of $1.13 per minute. It's insane. Healthcare companies. Telemarketing and call centers themselves, because up to 2004, 2,000 or more prisoners in the United States were working in call centers from their prisons. They were paid $120 to $185 a month, working 40 hours a week. Clothing manufacturers. They make a lot more than license plates in prisons. A wide variety of stuff. Even Victoria's Secret has profited from the prison-making industrial complex. In the 1990s, Victoria's Secret subcontractor Third Generation hired inmates from North Carolina to sew lingerie. Obviously, the technology sector during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, much of unionized manufacturing jobs went to the American middle class, but they also went to ultra-cheap labor here in the United States, with inmates earning as low as 35 cents an hour. The bail industry. Oh, the bail industry. According to the ACLU and the Nation, the bail industry now pulls in $2 billion in revenue annually. I have some personal experience with the bonds industry, the bail bonds industry here in New Jersey. As I've said on the program previous, I've been working on legislative issues surrounding mass incarceration for about 5 years now. And one of the legislative pieces that we were putting through was bail reform, which would require allow judges to start at no monetary bail whatsoever in each and every case that comes before them. Previously, with mandatory sentencing, they didn't have any options. So if somebody was being booked for XYZ, they had to give bail at a minimum of XYZ. And so we were able to remove that particular stipulation off of the ballot, which would allow people, I think that right after it went into effect, I think around 12,000 people actually got to just leave jail at that moment. And it's a really huge thing to kind of decrease the amount of people incarcerated here. The lone opposition to this law was the bail bond industry. So we're there lobbying people, and we have people giving testimony about what it does to families and how important it is. People are losing jobs. They're in jail just because they can't come up with $500. This is crazy. They didn't even do anything violent. All of these things. And they got up there, and literally their only pitch was that, well, they would lose money, and so tax revenue would go down. That's it. They didn't even have, I was like, oh, maybe they'll make up statistics. Maybe they would have some sort of like, it's dangerous. Nope. We're going to make less money. So you should keep these people locked up. That's it.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ricky.
What bothers me is that we sit up here and act like the economy is like infallible, mm-hmm. or that capitalism is infallible and the market is infallible. An economy, any economy, doesn't matter what kind of economy it is a logistical way of dividing the country's wealth. That's it. Mm-hmm. That is it. Absolutely. You make it, that society makes up the rules, and people make logical decisions based on those rules. So why would the bail industry, who is responsible for getting prisoners out of jail, want to keep more prisoners in jail? Why? Because it's better for their business model. We don't put these things together like, okay, this is the problem. Okay, well, let's make this no longer an incentive. Or let's make it easier for that bailsman to set up another small business in another arena. So that even if he does end up having to close this and fire people, 6 months later he can be up and running in a different industry and be doing better, and then hire more people. We don't think about these things.
And there also is just the notion of like, when is enough enough?
Yeah, exactly.
Because nobody was going to be going under. I think that's like that wasn't even their pitch. It wasn't that we were going to have to close our businesses. We would just be making less. Okay. And yeah. I mean, and what? It's not better for the economy to have people who were employed now locked up with their families unable to pay their bills, with them separated from their children. None of those things are good for the economy. But you making less money,
isn't it? No, those decrease tax revenue too.
Exactly. But no, you know, that's not how we set things up. The other thing I wanted to touch on is just this idea of anti-blackness and black exceptionalism when it comes to white supremacy, because I know it's a really big thorn in the side of anybody trying to bring this conversation to the fore, especially since our president took office, because we don't have racism. There's a black president because a few people are successful. Now all black people should be fine, right?
Yes.
Isn't that how it works?
Yes.
Not how it works.
And I mean, Rush said the same thing about Oprah when she was talking about racism, and he was like, "Well, how did you get here? How did you make it this far?" The fact that she's like the first one or one of the few kind of validates the point. You know what I mean? Like the fact that it's just her,
right?
Just and now woman. Michael
now
Jordan.
Michael Jordan.
That's
I guess
kind right? of the point. You know, it's kind of what we're talking about. How many white billionaires are there? Considerably more. You can't say that they've earned it. Right. We know that there's been racial disparity among wealth for generations. We planned it that way. She's the perfect example of of racism. What do you mean?
Absolutely.
It's just so stupid. I want to laugh because it's just that stupid, but it's so fucking harmful.
It is. It's so harmful. I had. Did you guys see that? Oh, go ahead, Leah. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I think I was going to say that it's also harmful when elite black people kind of accept that narrative about themselves when they don't see that, you know, even if they do reach that status, that one, there's very few of them, and two, their wealth does not equate to everyone else's. You know, that even if they are millionaires or part of the 1%, they're at the lower end of that. So it's
absolutely
not the same.
It's not the same. It's not the same. And also, you know, it doesn't take much for them to just be seen like every other black person either. You
right.
know, your wealth yeah. only gets you in so far as it's visibly obvious that you have that wealth.
Leslie, can you say that again for Karl Malone and Charles Barkley? Can you say that again for them one more time?
I don't know if they speak English, though, so I'm not 100% they're going to get it, quite frankly. I don't know.
True.
Take some brain power to kind of wrap their minds around that part, which is, of course, I mean, we saw that this summer where Charles M. Blow's son at Yale has a gun drawn on him going from the library to his room. And you know, you saw many people I don't even like Stephen A. Smith talks about how many times he's pulled over and then they realize it's him and they let him go, you know, just for nothing, you know. So this is not something that's unusual in our society. We know, obviously, when you're a face
but a joke,
like Oprah Winfrey and Barack Obama, people are gonna recognize you, and Karl Malone and Charles Barkley. But when you're just a regular ass rich black person, nobody knows who you are. I bet you Bob Johnson's been pulled over a few times. He's pretty rich, but don't nobody know who he is, and they don't care either. So, you know, it's definitely a situation of kind of having that realization. And I think a lot of, you know, you read histories. I don't know if you guys read Warmth of a Different Sun or Another Sun. One of the people in that book, they talk about, he was a doctor in California, and he was shocked at when he had to travel back home to the South. He hated it because he had to force himself back into this subjugated position when he was a doctor in California, his own practice, and all these people, you know, looked up to him and he was revered, and it was like he couldn't escape his blackness. It was all situational.
It's also like respectability politics can't save you. Mm-mm. So, you know, even if you hear all of the things that society respects, like getting higher education or going to church, dressing nice, smelling good, have your hair done, all those things, that will not save you from racism.
Sure.
And I think that's something that really we need to grab a hold to.
Absolutely.
And I mean, granted that it may make it a little less likely for you to experience it.
Yeah.
It doesn't really help your chances. Like, no one really, you know, at any point you could just be a nigger and need to go. That's if you can sit well with that, that says something something about you.
It does. And then I also think that there's a psychological aspect of this to those people that are exceptional and do excel. And when they're confronted with their blackness, it's very damaging psychologically. I don't know.
Yeah, there was an op-ed, now I'm forgetting it, but it was in the Washington Post not too long, I think in the fall, and it was a successful lawyer and his wife, and they talked about how they raised their children not to see color. And it was very damaging and traumatic for their oldest son when he was finally confronted with racism, because he was raised to believe that, you know, he excelled and he was exceptional and race didn't affect him, when in fact it did in a very damaging way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do remember that. I can't remember the title of the op-ed, but it was like, I taught my children. I can't remember. It was a provocative title. I do remember that.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can find it before I put the show notes up. And then they had the whole I too am Harvard, I too am MIT, which was kind of touching on microaggressions. Yeah. I think that was like last year. So there was a high school in Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, which is in the Maryland, D.C. area in the DMV, that they did an I2MBCC, a 6-minute YouTube video that talks about the pain and struggle of Black and Hispanic students at a high-performing suburban high school in Montgomery County, Maryland's largest school system. And it start the actual student that made their project, her name is Mercedes Hailu. She had just won a coveted spot on an academic team at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School when she inadvertently overheard a classmate's put down. Oh, she only got in because she's Black, end quote. At that moment, I just remember feeling so hurt for the rest of the year and throughout the team. I just felt like everyone was looking at me like, oh, I was the Black girl who made the team because she was Black and not because of merit. Now, this was just her one story, but she had a bunch of other students that came up talking about the same thing and this idea of, one, living in two different worlds. You're in a minority in this very, high level school, because as a professor said earlier, that we're segregated, so our schools are segregated, so the better schools are not going to have a whole lot of Black people in them because of that fact. And the pain that comes from that, and feeling like you have to be the best, you have to strive even harder, you have to prove that you belong there, when these mediocre white people are like, yeah, we belong here because we're white. And the psychological damage that comes along with that aspect of it. I went to an all-girls boarding school for high school, a very elite school, and we didn't have a ton of minority students. I think in my class, we had 93 people in my class, and I'd say 12 Black or Hispanic girls in the class, which actually is not that bad a percentage, but still not that many. And I remember there being this, like, why do you guys always sit together? Why, this idea of, needing us feeling like we needed to herd together because we didn't, there weren't a lot of us there. And at the same time being judged for that at this, in the same instance. And there's a psychological aspect to white supremacy that affects white people. And obviously it affects Black people too, and how we are able to reconcile that. That's how you get a Karl Malone and how you get a Charles Barkley, because it fucks with our minds. It's psychological warfare in terms of what we think of ourselves. To be bombarded consistently from the moment we're born with images and outward stimuli that tell us that we're less than, and striving to separate ourselves from that label.
Yeah. Or even forgetting that you have that label, like I did as a kid and still do as an adult.
much to your mother's chagrin.
Yes. I'm tired of my mama. I'm 30. I shouldn't have my mama reminding me that I'm still Black or that I'm Black. But again, it goes back to, like, and I always bring that up because it's not that I don't know I'm Black. It's that I forget that people view me differently because I'm Black, that I'm inherently more threatening because I'm Black, even when I'm not being threatening, when I'm minding my own fucking business. Apparently, I'm dangerous. And so it's something that's difficult for me to even accept. But the reality is that any time that I don't accept that, it's like not wearing my seatbelt.
Yeah.
In a 90-mile-an-hour car crash. You know, it's it can blow up in your face really, really quickly. That's why, when Leslie, when you say, your privilege will not protect you, it's absolutely true.
Absolutely. So we're going to move into Alina's area of expertise, which is museums and exhibition spaces. I know I mentioned on the last show about Blackout Tour, which was first conducted in New York City a couple of weeks ago at the Museum of Natural History. And it really got me thinking a lot about just museum spaces and how they go about not just being perpetuating white supremacy, but really in some instances being monuments to white supremacy in terms of how they push the narrative of what we are viewed as, both our historical context and current context. And I know, Aaliyah, first, if you could talk a little bit about the chat that you host every third Wednesday, which is Museums Respond to Ferguson, how that came about and what you guys discussed during the chat.
Yeah, so Museums Respond to Ferguson is an ongoing project. It initially started out with a couple of museum bloggers wanting to make a statement about Ferguson. And then Adrian Russell and I wanted to continue the conversation. We wanted to go beyond just making a statement about the event. And we really wanted to deconstruct what was going on in museums. So museums are very elitist spaces. And then on top of that, they often perpetuate racist ideas or anti-blackness ideas. And Adrian and I really wanted to get to the bottom of it, so we started hosting these chats. And it's been difficult for people to make that leap. They're not entirely willing to discuss a true history. Back to what we were talking about, the Founding Fathers, they're more interested in keeping the visitors happy and keeping board members happy, rather than actually telling the truth about some of the racial horrors that has happened. And one of the things that we've brought up is, by telling this false history, you're alienating the black population, which no one seems to care about. They're always talking about alienating visitors and board members, but they don't see that what they're doing, what they're exhibiting, what they're choosing to collect, what they're doing education programs on, is alienating black people and, further pushing them out of that space. So that's primarily what my research deals with, is how do we decolonize museums? How do we make them more inclusive spaces that tell full narratives and not just, make them monuments or relics to white supremacy?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And so do you usually choose a specific theme or topic or a specific museum? How is the chat kind of structured?
So, we choose a theme for each month. And fortunately, our themes have gone pretty well. But we've talked about, first we started with how museums responded to Ferguson. And we found out that a lot of museums didn't, or they told their employees that they shouldn't respond to Ferguson at all. They shouldn't talk about race if it ever came up. There are a few that responded to Ferguson, but not many. Like, overall, the idea was to stay away from it. We've also talked about, internally, how do museums perpetuate anti-blackness? So we've looked at hiring practices, what they collect, what they choose to interpret. And then we've also talked about how the chat has helped people dismantle racism, or how they've seen oppression in museums or learned about their own prejudices and biases. So, we go through these different themes, and then we ask a couple of questions. Usually it's only three questions because it generates so much thought that we can't go past three because we only have an hour. So.
Gotcha. Awesome. And when's the next one? I'll be posting it on the Ferguson Response. Tell
the
me as well,
next
but.
One is the third Wednesday, which I believe is the, I should know this off the top. Yeah, it's the 18th.
18th. Okay, awesome.
So March 18th, and it's 2 to 3 p.m.
Fantastic. And like I said, that will be posted on the Ferguson Response Tumblr as well for that day. So that's great context for kind of this idea of what museum spaces are in terms of perpetuating white supremacy and also, you know, not giving a positive context for Black people to go to museum spaces and learn correct history, not just about themselves, but also about white people and about our country and about the world, generally speaking. You know, the biggest, you know, I asked my husband, I said, what would you say is the most or the least discussed effect of white supremacy? And he said, well, I think that the least discussed is the fact that white supremacy forces everyone to center normal around whiteness, and anything that's not white is other. And so when you come at everything from that stance, white normal, white normal, white normal, it coats everything. It's like, you know, a layer of paint over everything that is said, written, done, because that centering is always consistently on whiteness. Real quick from the Blackout Tour, which I'll have a link to the actual tour syllabus itself that they did at the Museum of Natural History. They stopped in the Hall of African Peoples, and they mentioned that cultural artifacts are not natural history. It's important to first note that there is no Hall of European Peoples in this museum. While many people of color are represented next to exhibits of their geographic animal counterparts, unlike most other exhibits in the History Museum, this exhibit's text is written in present tense, adding to the mysticism and misunderstanding of the modern Black/African experience. African peoples are presented naked in primitive settings as examples of present culture. The tiny set-aside section on slavery implies that the idea for American slavery originated with African people themselves and includes no mention of the European people who actually perpetrated these genocides and crimes against humanity. African culture is only represented in its relation to white people. Thus, this is an exhibit on erasure and white supremacy, not at all on African culture or peoples. So it's a really good kind of illustration of it. And truthfully, this may be some middle schooler from Buffalo's only experience with African history ever in their whole life. If they came to New York, this may be the only time that they're ever put in a space that they would learn about any of that. And that is what they're learning. So it's definitely a huge thing. And I loved seeing your chat and seeing just the conversations that were there. The Storify was really great to kind of go through and see all of you wonderful museum professionals talking about these things. And I know that the idea for Blackout Tours, for it to continue in other locations and eventually have a bunch of syllabi out there for all sorts of museums to kind of give a different narrative to what's out there, especially in historical context. So I think that'll be really cool. What other thoughts did you have, Ali, outside of just the chat, kind of in the work that you're doing and have done previously that you see?
I'm just really proud of the Blackout Tour, and I hope it just continues because it will force people within the profession to reckon with that history. And another excuse that they've often used is being afraid of offending or upsetting people. And if you have visitors saying that we want this history and, you know, we're going to protest or form some type of action if we don't get it, that will make them listen more, hopefully. So I'm very excited for people standing up and owning their history. And, you know, they're absolutely right. The way that museums portray Black history, whether it's African or African-American history, is often very problematic. So, yeah. And it needs to change. So I'm very excited about the Blackout Tours.
Absolutely. So we're going to move into our final, a couple of things we wanted to touch on. I know we're going a little bit long. Hope that's okay with both of you guys. But we talked a little bit about, just there was a mention of the concept of food deserts. And I wanted to bring it up because it's such a huge effect of white supremacy and segregation, you know, subsequently as well. And I don't think that the average white person even gets the concept of it. So, Ricky, if you want to just run down what it means and kind of what the phenomenon is of a food desert, generally speaking.
Generally speaking, it's an area that doesn't have very many options as far as nutritious food. There's not many grocery stores. There aren't very many markets in the area. It's mostly just fast food places. I grew up in quite a few of these areas. So I have intimate experience.
Yep. Absolutely.
But, mm-hmm. you know, you think about Walmart, how Walmart is fucking everywhere, right? Do you know in South L.A.? Finally got a Walmart, it hadn't even been 10 years. Less than 10 years ago, the southern part of the second largest city in the United States didn't have a Walmart.
Wow.
And now there's just that one. Shit.
Just the one.
That's it. In all of South LA.
Mm-hmm.
That's a damn shame. But again, it goes back to this, like, not really being able to get nutritious food. Who is it? I don't know if you've watched that show, Bring It.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so I don't know if you saw the episode when they were talking about Kayla and how she's gaining weight.
No, I didn't see that. Is that last week's episode? I have it on my DVR. I haven't watched it yet.
I think so. But it talks about how she's, like, they finally talk about her putting on weight. And, mind you, I know all this because Sherelle works on the show.
Right.
She made me start watching it, and then, like, after the first episode, I was like, oh, okay, I can get into actually watching this. This is cool. But, it talks about how it's not really, it's expensive to buy, it's more expensive to buy healthier food in a food desert. And you don't really have a lot of options. She's like, it cost me $10 to get an apple and a banana, but you know, I go to McDonald's and I got a full meal for $3.99 or for $7. Which one would you take? Rather be hungry off of a couple pieces of fruit or full off of bullshit?
Absolutely, it's totally true. You know, when Drew and I lived in Argentina, it was one of the starkest things that we noticed, which is that fast food was way more expensive than actually shopping at either the open air markets or at the actual grocery store to get fresh food. And it wasn't just seen as a treat. It was like a frivolous treat to go to a fast food restaurant. And it was shocking to see that, you know, you getting a chicken to cook and vegetables, sides, everything at a, you know, market to bring home to cook was a quarter of the price of going to like Burger King or McDonald's there. And you can see it on the populace that the idea is that you should be eating the good food and not this bad stuff, which, yeah, it's okay to have for a treat, but it's not meant to be your sustenance. And we've allowed corporations to come into our poor neighborhoods because they rule. And we have bad grocery stores that leave the area. And even when they have decent grocery stores, you know, even in a city like Baltimore, huge pockets of Baltimore, people have to take two or three buses just to get to a grocery store to buy their groceries from. I think 20% of the city of Baltimore residents live in a food desert. 20%.
Yeah, I went to undergrad at Coppin State University in Baltimore, and that was the first time I lived in a food desert, and I just realized how inconvenient it was to eat decent food. Because, you know, I either had to find a ride or, like you said, catch several buses to go to a decent grocery store. And even right now I do live in a food desert, but I often think about, like, I have a car, so I can I do have the ability to drive to a decent grocery store or farmer's market. But I think about the people who don't have cars, and even just the thought of going to a grocery store and having to transport groceries and, like, all the necessity items that you need to sustain yourself, it's just overwhelming. So I think there's also a mental part that plays in that, too.
Absolutely. It's a mental part, and it gets to the fact that regarding most neighborhood segregation, there were 4 times more supermarkets located in white neighborhoods compared to black neighborhoods. And then the flip side of that, 3 times fewer places to consume alcoholic beverages in the wealthier neighborhoods when compared to poorer ones. So what's replacing these healthy alternatives to eat are escapism activities and escapism outlets, fast food, quick marts, and alcoholic beverage consumption entities.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and you don't even have to be you don't necessarily even have to be poor anymore.
No.
You can be lower middle class.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm not technically poor, but I also feel I'm also in situations a few times where I feel like, do I eat healthy or do I be full for a week? That shouldn't be a choice for someone, especially for someone who's not poor.
Right. It shouldn't be a luxury to eat fresh foods and fruits and vegetables.
Shouldn't be a luxury to be able to be able to eat fresh foods and be full.
Absolutely.
You know, even if you don't want to, fine. Right. You don't want to. Go eat all the fast foods you want. But the thing is that if you wanted to go buy something healthy, it should be affordable. We create food deserts for people, not just from a location standpoint, but just from an economic basis. You could live.
Right.
I don't live in a food desert, but there are times where I feel like I'm in a food desert because I ain't really got the money.
Right, and that's a real concern for everybody.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we'll move on to one of the larger issues in terms of white supremacy's effect on the black populace, which is housing. And obviously this has been an issue for decade after decade, century after century at this point, when we talk about things like redlining and, deliberate segregation, and white flight, all of these concepts that I think are pretty well known. But I wanted to talk about 2 things that maybe the average person isn't aware of. One is the effect of the subprime mortgage crisis on black homeowners, which, has been beyond devastating in comparison to their white counterparts. We have been victim of predatory loans at a staggering rate when compared to white counterparts. And the crisis, we are the only portion of the population that has yet to even start to bounce back from the effects of the subprime mortgage crisis. So, Ricky, just quick thoughts on that and kind of how that came to be and the background on it a little bit.
Well, basically, Bank of America, well, it was countrywide at the time, but Bank of America was doing the practice too. And they were actually doing it a lot sooner. You would basically steer people who were credit-wise perfectly deserving of a regular, a non-subprime loan, and you shift them into a subprime loan, which had higher interest rates, worse terms, and they didn't even know it.
Yep.
They weren't made aware of it at all. They were perfectly and it was done primarily to black people because it was thought that they were more likely to be deceived. The reality is, if no one tells you what you're eligible for at a fucking bank, you're not going to know.
Nope.
Unless you shop around and maybe one of them tells you. But if they all play the same fucking game with you, you don't know you're being taken advantage of. So, basically, when the subprime when the bubble collapsed, people with subprime mortgages were the first to go because their mortgages were written with such fucked up terms, you know, balloon payments, and I mean, there was so much that was done in those contracts that people lost their homes, and most people, and particularly the American middle class, had their wealth built up through a home. That was the thing that you did. When you got a full-time job, you worked there for a little bit, you got a decent promotion, you went and bought a house. And that was the way that you built wealth in America, period. And that was, we were, black people were largely robbed of that in 2008.
And we had been robbed of that prior to this, might I also
exactly.
add, on a consistent basis. I mean, you do talk about
exactly.
redlining and all of and
they gave that. It to us for like 20 years, y'all. They let us buy houses and shit for like 20 years. My grandparents was able to slide in. I mean, it would have been kind of nice if I could have done the same. I thought it was pretty fucked up, but hey.
Absolutely. And then there was this other thing that I noticed, and it's funny. Drew and I are about to sell our house now, and I had said to him, and this was, you know, when I said it to him, he like looked at me like I was crazy. I said, hey, you know, we don't have a lot of picture photos in the house. Mostly it's artwork. We have one portrait of us hanging in the living room, and I said, you know, maybe we should take that down before we start showing the house. And he said, why? I said, I have a feeling it might, even if it's a little bit, it might be a detriment for somebody to think they're buying a house from a black person. And he was like, yeah. What are you talking about? Why would you think that? And I said, because supremacy. Like, that was my literal answer to him, was because supremacy. And I didn't have any data. I just honestly was thinking about,
the data's there.
You know, putting ourselves in the best position. But then, of course, after he balked, I went to take a look and see, you know, if there was data, and the data absolutely is there. Black homes are consistently deemed less valuable than white homes of the same area, size, and condition. On touring homes, if a black person is seen to have been the owner, white buyers tend to think that the house will then be less better taken care of because a black owner would owned it, which is completely ridiculous because the opposite is actually true. In fact, in terms of conditioning of homes, black people take very good care of their homes. It's a source of pride and a point of pride for black people on the whole. As Ricky said, it's not something we generally take for granted. So we do take it very seriously when we are able to own one. When selling a home, it becomes a real detriment, generally speaking. And, you know, this is one of those insidious things about white supremacy that you can't legislate your way out of. You're never going to pass a bill or a law that's going to make people stop thinking that they should pay less for a black person's home.
Yeah. However, and I think we kind of give ourselves the easy way out when we point, because we know that, but the thing we always forget is that we can pass shit to offset that.
True.
There's a measurable effect that we can pass legislation to offset it. So, you know, it's almost like fatalistic because some people stop short at just that idea.
Right. Absolutely.
Just because you can't fix the problem doesn't mean that you can't counterbalance the problem
with something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Aaliyah, what were your thoughts on that? Just kind of the housing aspect of white supremacy and how it shows up in black
people. I was pretty much agreeing with you all. I don't think I have anything extra to add. Maybe also just to again point out the generational effects of, you know, a parent who may have lost their home and how that affects how they can provide for their child and what generational wealth they can pass to the child. So,
absolutely. So the last thing we wanted to talk about is medical treatment, which is a huge issue in the black community. And we have study after study that shows that black Americans receive shoddy, poor medical treatment for a myriad of reasons, all of which the root of is white supremacy. So Aaliyah, I don't know if you knew too much about that or had any thoughts kind of about that, the psychological aspects of that and kind of what happens when black people are interacting with medical profession and how they are treated, really.
Yeah, you know, I've even just thought about my personal experiences, you know, when I read the articles that you linked and just even the interaction with medical professionals, like, they'll be surprised that I'm getting a PhD or surprised that I'm not pregnant or, you know, so it's like, how do we even trust someone when they're starting a medical, like, professional relationship from that standpoint, where you're assuming that I'm going to be uneducated about myself and my health, and you're responsible. So, no, just from personal interactions and looking at history, it all kind of aligns.
Absolutely. You know, and it's, I mean, it's across the board. African-American patients with heart symptoms are only half as likely to be referred to the best treatments and testing as their white counterparts. African-American women are less likely to get cancer screenings. We are discharged in unstable conditions more than white people. We make up 35% of reported AIDS cases and nearly one half of all AIDS deaths. Psychiatric clinicians spend less time with African-American patients than with their patients of other races. So this is across the board, every area of the medical profession, whether it be diagnosis, through treatment, through aftercare, and through consistent care, we are seeing that we are treated less than in a profession whose entire purpose is to help others. So we are shown that we're not the other that's supposed to be helped, or certainly not in the same way. I have actually a friend who has a strange job. She is a medical actor, and that she actually, for her living, works for several medical schools here in Philadelphia, and she pretends to have symptoms of certain things and helps the students learn how to do certain exams and things like that. And so one of the things, she's heavier, and one of the things that she says is a lot of times that heavier people, especially if they're black, they will not get a correct heart check because the doctor won't want to invade the person's space, or they'll feel like they don't need to. And so she's there trying to teach these students, like, nope, come on, you got to get in there. You know, you've got to really assess me correctly. And it really got me thinking about how are we teaching these skills, and are we pushing the envelope with regard to race in the medical school level and residency level to combat these inherent biases that we just tend to have as human beings in the country and in the world, really. I don't think, to my knowledge, there's anything out there that's consistently trying to do that. I think there's this idea that because they're medical professionals that they're going to, you know, do the right thing. What do you think, Ricky?
All I have to say is Dr. Ben Carson. Bam. That disproves that shit right there. Rand Paul. Well, if you need backup proof.
Yeah. For sure.
I mean, the being a doctor and being good at medical stuff doesn't make you a genius, and it doesn't even make you able to recognize things within society. You can be book smart and a great doctor and just fairly okay with people, just enough to get by to do your job, and not know shit about people, not know shit about how racism works, not know shit in general. Rand Paul. I'm sorry, that was a low blow.
Yeah, I know, but it's Rand Paul, so it's okay.
Yeah, true.
No, it's so true. I saw a funny quote this morning about Ben Carson. It was like, you know, smart hands, stupid brain, or something like that. It was
yes. Oh. Oh. Well,
oh, yeah. Gifted, it said gifted hands, broken brain. That's what it said. Because he had it.
Wow.
I thought it was really perfect because it's very.
You know what? Something tells me, like, I keep hoping that, like, in the back of my mind somewhere, that he's just pretending to be really, really conservative so that once he gets in the White House, he can act an ass and they won't. They won't necessarily do anything to him, but the more he talks, the less that seems that's the case.
Yeah, no, I don't think.
Like, no, maybe he's pretending. Oh shit, he believes this. No, I'm being naive now.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. Okay, so we've gone through all of these different things. I want to give each of us kind of a minute to just give our final thoughts about the history of white supremacy in the country, at the roots of our country, and its hidden effects today. So I'll start with you, Ricky. What do you got for me?
Well, I think it's important to remember that there's a dynamic where, and you kind of see this throughout all American history. Conservatives have been fucking this country over since before it was a country. Liberals have been trying to make it better, but both of them have been shitting on black people in the process. You know, this notion that there can't be equality because somehow people are inherently more violent just because they have more melanin. Like, does melanin cause aggression? None of this shit makes any sense. And when you look at it objectively, it's so obvious that it almost makes you wonder what the hell is wrong with people. But it goes back to it being like privilege being so blinding. Like the experience that I had with black women lives or black women's lives matter and black trans lives matter. I'm like, yeah, isn't that fucking common sense? And then I had to go check myself. Like, oh wait, it isn't.
If only it was.
And I was like, man, you know, my privilege of being, you know, cisgender male is I can assume that it's about everyone and it not harm me. That's wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. Aliyah, how about you? Final thoughts.
I think my final thought is that dismantling white supremacy is an ongoing thing. It's something that we aren't going to solve if we don't fully and intentionally commit to it. You know, racism evolved over time. You know, slavery and as we know it is gone, but there are certainly other ways, institutional and through personal interactions, that white supremacy still lives. So I think we need to recognize that it's an ongoing struggle and we have to stay strong and keep fighting it.
Absolutely. I'm going to quote Michael Eric Dyson real quick. He says, white supremacy is the conscious or unconscious belief or the investment in the inherent superiority of some while others are believed to be innately inferior, and it doesn't demand the individual participation of the singular bigot. It's a machine operating in perpetuity because it doesn't demand that somebody be in place driving. And I say that because I wanted to use that quote because, you know, we say systemic, which is what white supremacy is, because a system doesn't require anything. It runs on its own. And so we need to start to understand that fact. It's the only way for us to kind of break this barrier and start to look at the ways in which it seeps into our society that we don't notice, because again, it's running without anybody making it go. It is just the way that things are run currently because our system has always been set up to run that way. And so we have to come to terms with the past. We have to acknowledge what has occurred, and we also have to acknowledge the ways that we are perpetuating it currently in our present. I think the Department of Justice report is great because it gives some tangible specifics in terms of how white supremacy shows itself, certainly in our criminal justice system and with regard to black people interacting with law enforcement. But I also hope it doesn't come to us needing a Department of Justice report for every goddamn city in this country to know that this is happening everywhere and that there's nothing special about Ferguson, in fact. The only special thing about Ferguson is that the protesters there decided that they just were fucking over it and they were not going to stop until somebody listened to them and heard the things that they were saying. And I also don't think it needed a report, 100-page report, to say the things that they have been shouting since August 9th in Ferguson, and way before that, as a matter of fact, had been going on to them on a consistent basis. So perhaps I'm optimistic slightly. Perhaps this Department of Justice report will allow all people to open their ears and shut their fucking mouths for once and listen to people of color when they tell you that they're being discriminated against. We're not crazy. We're not making it up. It's not something that's in our imagination. These are real, tangible fights that we have to deal with on a regular basis. And I hope that we can start to have these conversations in wider circles and that more people will listen. I'm going to do a quick shout out to a group called Frozen Justice. They're a snow art campaign that's taking place in the Cleveland area to remind the public that the deaths of Tanisha Anderson and Tamir Rice were ruled homicides, yet no charges have been brought against each other. It's really amazing. They're taking stencils and spray paint and putting up art installations all over the area, mostly during rush hour and in large high traffic places. That say justice for Tamir, justice for Tanisha, and some other things. And I'll put links to that on the show notes as well. But it's a really visual and stirring tribute to Tanisha and Tamir in a way of keeping the area aware that they are not forgotten and that the fight continues, especially as charges, civil charges are being filed in those cases coming up. Thanks for joining us. And again, if you want to find myself, you can find me on Twitter almost all the time at Leslie Mack, M-A-C. You can find Ferguson Response at thefergusonresponse.org. If you have activities or actions coming up in your area, you can list them or find them at fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. You can find my illustrious co-host, Ricky, occasionally on Twitter at AUADOT.org, and most of the time on Facebook at facebook.com/AUA Movement, and always on his website at AUAMovement.org. And Aaliyah, you can find on Twitter, she mentioned at the top of the show, at Aaliyah Brown, A-L-E-I-A, and on Instagram at, that Aaliyah Brown, T-H-A-T-A-L-E-I-A Brown, and her website, AaliyahBrown.com, and I'll make sure that I have all of those items on the show notes. Thanks so much, you guys, for joining me. I really appreciate it. I know it was a long show, but a really good one. I think we got through a lot of great information here, kind of diving into this white supremacy thing.
Definitely.
Great, yeah.
For sure.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much. All right, everyone, have a great night.